I think it's kind of plagued by the notion of genre. You see, if you start telling a ghost story, you have to tell the story within a framework of genre filmmaking. And genre filmmaking, you end up in some kind of movie Never Never Land. It's very American in a way. I mean, it's this notion that there's the visible and there's the invisible, there's the good and the bad, and whatever is not visible is evil, is the evil with a capital E. That's, of course, not the way I see it.
Last year's winner of the Best Director Award at Cannes, Olivier Assayas. He'll join me in the studio to discuss his brazen new genre-flipping film, Personal Shopper, starring Kristen Stewart.
But how do you know if it's a sign?
I'm a medium. He was a medium. I'll just know it.
And we'll take a look at one of the few ghost stories that Assayas says gets it all absolutely right. The classic Henry James novella, The Turn of the Screw, and its 1961 screen adaptation, The Innocents.
Heavens, child, you're white as milk.
I saw him. Don't tell me I didn't, because I did. I saw him staring.
Who, miss?
The same man, the man on the tower.
The tower?
But now, just now, he was staring past me into the house.
That's all to come on this special edition of The Cinema Show with Olivier Assayas on Monocle 24.
What are you doing in Paris?
I'm waiting. I'm gonna go.
What are you waiting for?
My brother died here. My twin brother died in Paris.
An accident?
No, heart attack. I actually have the same malformation.
In her day job as a personal shopper to a socialite celebrity, Maureen enjoys a casual flirtation with the glamorous high fashion world of Paris. When she's not busy choosing outfits on behalf of her bratty boss, Maureen quietly tries some of the outfits. And though she's constantly surrounded by the chaotic rhythm of the French capital, the two people closest to her are actually located somewhere else entirely. Her boyfriend, with whom she speaks via a laptop screen, and her brother, who recently passed away.
You're staying here tomorrow?
No, I'm waiting. I told you I was waiting.
What are you waiting for?
So we made this oath. Whoever died first would send the other a sign.
A sign? From the afterlife?
You could call it that. You could call it a million things.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Beautifully strange, delicately unsettling, and just ridiculous enough. They're some of the ways that the new film by Olivier Assayas has been described. Personal Shopper is a genre-defying curiosity that, despite winning Assayas the Best Director Award at Cannes, still had many critics flapping their jaws at the idea of a legitimate filmmaker swatting away any degree of subtlety. But for Assayas, the art of filmmaking isn't about ticking boxes or mapping out expectations, and he's certainly not one to feel constrained by the concept of genre.
I like making movies that are surprising in the sense that it's what's entertaining for an audience. You know, if you tell a story according to established patterns, I mean, people will be like mildly surprised or not surprised at all. Or they will know, basically, of course, they don't know the story, but they kind of know the codes. What I love doing is movies that, you know, like kind of play with codes, with twist them. Personal Shopper has element of genre filmmaking. Hopefully it's an entertaining film. Hopefully it's it's in many ways it's also a fun film. It's also dealing with things that are like pretty dark, which is about how we communicate, how we grieve, and how we manage to overcome our grief. And so I thought that this is a very universal story, and it's exciting if it's told in an unusual way, because it just, instead of giving you, you know, the usual route, you kind of approach it, looking at it from an angle maybe you haven't, somehow stimulates your thought process.
So much of the publicity surrounding the film involves Kristen Stewart wearing some beautiful clothing adorned in high fashion, and much of that is involved in the film as well. But the opening shot takes us to a creepy old house, which I found quite jarring. It went against what I was expecting. Yeah. I wondered if you could explain to me a little bit about how you see the role.
It's a character study, really. I mean, what this film is about is this young girl who is in the process of reconstructing herself after losing her brother. And but what interested me in using fashion as a backdrop is that, you know, this is as materialistic as it gets. I mean, it's like all about surface. And I really wanted to have someone who is involved in that tension, I mean, who is defined by that tension between a very mundane, borderline, boring job that she somehow despises, but who is also ambivalent about it, you know, in the sense that, yes, she's a personal shopper for this celebrity, more alienating and duller than that, it's hard to find. But at the same time, you know, she's young, she's at this weird moment, and she's also questioning her own femininity, her own identity, or her own gender, or whatever. And in that sense, every day with that kind of, with the glamour of the fashion industry, she has to admit that it gets to her. She, in the process of the film, will realize that it's not as clear-cut as it seemed.
You've presented some characters there. They seem to be possessed by their reliance on fashion. Her employer seems to be someone who uses high fashion and materialistic beauty, something that underpins her confidence in her everyday life. And yet there's a moment where Kristen Stewart tries on some of that clothing and admits that she feels ridiculous. So it almost feels as though the clothing is maybe some extension of a metaphor about us relying on external objects.
Well, you know, it's her boss, Kira. She's this celebrity, so she goes to functions, to social events, and she gets photographed a lot. So she, you know, she needs this constant turnout of, you know, of styles, and she has no time to handle that. So she uses that. But I think that that's how the fashion industry works, really. You know, that's pretty much part of the everyday life of a lot of those people. But what I'm interested in is more the proletariat of the fashion industry. You know, just people who are just doing the stupid jobs of carrying bags around on their bikes, and, you know, and getting this or that brand to lend them this and that, and then having to bring it back. I liked it very much, the idea that she had a job that was very physical and tough, physically tough. Where I wanted to get at is that she's ambivalent in the same way we're ambivalent in terms of our relationship to the modern world, you know, because it's taken as granted, you know, I'm saying the modern world is alienated, materialistic, we all know that, and it's not a positive way of looking at it, but at the same time, we are attracted by it. We can enjoy it in many ways, even disturbing to ourselves. So she's a contemporary character in that sense.
I had a sign.
Are you sure?
There was a presence.
Do you think Louis is here?
I don't know. Kira?
I'm just going to drop these bags for you, okay?
Hey.
What about some of the environments that these characters inhabit? Maybe most obviously would be Kira's apartment. We don't get to see a lot about her inner personality. With the environment that she inhabits then, is that maybe an extension onto, as you say, term her as a shadow? Because just looking at her, some of her furnishings, some of the objects that are scattered around, it looks like someone has gone through there and filled her apartment according to a list of directions, because there's not really a lot about her.
It's there's no life in it. I mean, the same way as she hires someone to shop for her, she has hired some designer to decorate her apartment. It's this kind of expensive, impersonal property. I was interested, obviously, in this kind of impersonality because again, I mean, you know, we're dealing with a character who's all surface. Usually when I write, I don't have a clear notion notion of the space, of the locations. And it's really when I start working on a film, visiting a location, that I kind of make sense of whatever works with the film. In this case, I had a very precise notion. I wanted those kind of, you know, just a big apartment with that kind of Antonioni feel to it, you know, like Rome in the 1960s. That's why we ended up building a few sets, including that one. Flat is more of a dreamscape than an actual flat.
So how involved were you in that sort of process then? Did you decide on some of the actual fashion items that Kira would own?
I'm usually very open, and you know, I kind of listen to what the costume designer brings us. But it's pretty close to what I had in mind. There were very specific directions in the screenplay in terms of the clothes, in terms of the dresses, and again, I mean, in terms of the sets, I really got involved more than usual, I suppose. Because for some reason this story came with places, you know. To me, it was extremely dependent on the space and how the different moods of the specific location. So yeah, I mean, I got very involved in that. In that part, more than usual.
Describing Personal Shopper to someone unfamiliar with the film can be quite difficult. Is it a fashion film? Well, yes, but with ghosts. So is it a horror movie? Well, maybe a little, but certainly not like any other I've seen. After explaining my thoughts on the film to a friend, she stopped me to ask if it were actually a comedy. It's really not, but a quick summary of the film can sound a little bit ridiculous. And that's part of what's so impressive here. We often equate artistic filmmaking with subtle plotting and the suggestion of mood. But with a series of twists and literal supernatural interjections, Assayas turns just about every expectation on its head and, in the process, achieves something entirely original. Talk to me about the supernatural element. I find this so much fun. I always get so depressed about films that just, they want to play with the supernatural, but they either take it too seriously or they don't take it seriously enough. And I feel like the tone in this got it just right. And I was quite happy to just go along with the ride, and I found it so much fun. How seriously, when you were creating the film, how seriously did you take the supernatural element?
I think it's both serious and fun. I mean, it's serious in the sense that, you know, it's a supernatural, ghost, paranormal. You know, they are just code words for what's happening in our brains. You know, we're not sure how our brain functions. We don't know where obsessions, fantasies come from. I mean, you know, so we deal with that mystery on every single day of our lives. If you want to try and transcribe it in narrative terms, it ends up to be genre filmmaking, you know. But ultimately, it's as intimate and as important in our everyday life as whatever job, whatever we do that is solid and material. At the same time, I'm having fun with it because there's always something a bit off, right? You know, in this notion of communicating with the afterlife or to communicating with the other world. I really like the idea of someone who really wants to believe, but ultimately does not really believe, even in her own abilities. I mean, we present the character of Maureen as a medium, but she's not sure she's a medium, and the very notion of herself being a medium is disturbing to her. I mean, she doesn't like the idea so much, and she's not that sure that it actually works. I'm kind of using this gray zone, you know, between believing and not believing, between taking it seriously and being, you know, just having a slight, you know, tongue-in-cheek approach to it.
Would that describe your own personal relationship
Yes, totally. I think we are, but I don't think I'm special in that sense. I mean, I think we are all like that. I mean, you know, at the same time, we know that there's a little bit more to the world than what we see and touch. You know, there's more to it. There's a lot of stuff that it's just too small for us to see or too weird for us to see. You have radio waves or whatever. You know, there's a lot going on around us that just our eyes don't imprint. We all have to deal with loss, absence, departed, that, you know, friends, parents we loved and who stay with us, you know, we are another. You know, I'm not sure of the actual reality of the presence of ghosts or any kind of afterlife. But then at the same time, I know that those presences live through us in a strange way. So they are part of us. On one side, if we're talking science, no, there are no ghosts. But we, if we're talking literature, or if we're talking psychology, or if we're talking art, there's nothing but, you know, it's more important than anything else.
I feel like your film also plays upon our ability to trust ourselves and what we may or may not have actually just experienced. Mm. There are a couple of moments that you feel like something just happened, but then something else happens to make you question whether you interpreted that in the right way. Are you trying to pick up on maybe your own sort of relationship with the supernatural as well, in that maybe even if you did feel like you experienced something that could be described as supernatural, maybe it didn't actually happen, maybe it was just you?
I think it's easier to discuss if we just think of how we feel when we have lost someone very close to us. And even more so if it's someone like, you know, like Maureen has lost her twin. So it puts us in a situation, in a moment of sensitivity, of hypersensibility, that makes us react to anything, to any sign. I mean, you know, we are obsessed with something that's not there and won't be here ever again. But still, we're waiting for that something to give us a sign. We brush it aside because, of course, it's not here. But still, I mean, it's something we very deeply sense.
This is perfect. This works. Thank you. This too. I see this.
Some have called Personal Shopper the best ghost story in decades, and there's certainly a good reason for that. It's an incredibly effective film, but also the ghost genre is so rarely explored by filmmakers brave and talented enough to tackle the psychological complexities that underpin our fascination with things that go bump in the dark. After I saw the film for the first time, I found myself wandering around London thinking about other films that have perfected the puzzle of psychological thriller. It is admittedly a fairly lonely list, but there is one film that really stands out, which we've spoken about before on The Cinema Show. The Innocents, made in 1961, takes place just outside this chilly old city at a big, creepy mansion. Let's take a step inside.
We lay, my love and I, beneath a weeping willow.
After taking a new job as the governess of an English country mansion, the elegant and proper Miss Giddens finds herself wandering through the beautiful, lush gardens of Bly, the setting that is to become her new home. She is to be the guardian of two children, Flora and her brother Miles. There's also a maid on call, Mrs. Gross, and a small staff. And there may or may not be a couple of other inhabitants too.
I never imagined it would be so beautiful.
Well, we do our best. Though half the rooms are empty now. Locked and empty. All the same, it's too big. A job to keep clean. But what I always say is it's a heaven for children.
Oh, yes, a heaven.
Miles has just been sent home from boarding school for reasons not entirely clear. Despite a youthful charisma, something else lurks beneath his grin. When Miles and Flora talk amongst themselves, just what is it they're discussing? Mrs. Gross insists it's just children's talk. Miss Giddens is sure she's wrong.
Watching me.
And who did you think it was?
Why, Miss Giddens, you came out without your hat.
So did you. How did you get here, dear?
In the boat.
Miss Giddens.
And when did you learn to row, Laura?
Miles taught me.
Why did you come here?
I always come here when I want to dance, when I want to be alone.
Based upon the 1898 novella The Turn of the Screw by Henry James, The Innocents really is a film like no other. Those accustomed to the modern habit of shock and gore might like to take a leaf from director Jack Clayton's masterful use of minimalism and Freudian symbolism. The script was co-written by Truman Capote, and his trademark air of gothic horror echoes through the halls of Bly House.
mixing bold lighting techniques with disorienting cinematography by Freddie Francis, The Innocence permeates with a sense of growing unease, a feeling of detachment from the outside world, a lingering suspicion that something is lurking in the dark, proof that there's nothing more terrifying than the unknown.
Are you ill?
Where are the children?
Anna's giving them their milk. Carriage is ready, miss.
From now on, we must never let them out of our sight. We can't take the slightest chance.
Of what?
She was here.
With its pioneering use of synthesized electronic sounds, the atmospheric gloom is so wonderfully precise, it's little wonder that critics of the 1960s lauded The Innocence as the greatest ghost story ever put on the screen. A look back at the wonderfully unsettling 1961 film The Innocence, starring Deborah Carr, and based, of course, on the classic Henry James story, The Turn of the Screw. Still to come on The Cinema Show, Olivier Assayas discusses his screenwriting process and why all his films are at least a little bit supernatural, even if you never noticed. Stay tuned.
Well, I'm sure they could talk about things, but they like to talk about it. A lot of directors and actors like to run their movies. You know, their idea of a happy night at home is to turn on the projector and see one of their pictures again, you know. And I can't think of anything more horrifying, you know, because you can't change it. Yes. What can you do about it?
Yes.
There it is,
yes.
Forever. And if you're, you know, if you're a writer and you've written a bad chapter, and they're going to bring out another edition, if you're lucky enough of your works, you get to fix up that chapter. Nothing you can do about a movie. There it is, locked in forever.
That's Orson Welles speaking to Michael Parkinson in 1974. Before his death in 1985, he was hard at work on his final project, The Other Side of the Wind. The legendary filmmaker's unfinished swan song has frustrated and fascinated Welles enthusiasts for decades. Now, it seems we might finally see a vision of what had been intended. One of the original line producers who worked with Orson Welles on the film is part of a new quest to finish the film, and they've just received a big boost after partnering with Netflix. The film is understood to be a satire of arthouse film directors set around a party being held at a filmmaker's house shortly before his impending death. We'll examine another masterpiece that never was on next week's program when we visit the Barbican here in London for a very special Fashion in Film event dedicated to the French filmmaker Henri-Georges Clouzot. And don't forget that MUBI is presenting a special look at the work of slow cinema champion Lav Diaz. Subscribers in the US and the UK can catch the 2012 drama Florentino Hubaldo, CTE, in all its epic six-hour glory. Lav Diaz was in London recently for a Q&A session at the Regent Street Cinema. We brought you the whole event as part of a special bonus edition earlier in the week. Check our website for details. And of course, you can always try a whole month of movies for free by heading over to mubi.com/monocle. That is MUBI/monocle. They throw a different title into the mix every day, so you'll never fall into the endless scrolling trap again. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Still with me is the writer and director of the new film Personal Shopper, Olivier Assayas. Olivier, we were just looking back at the 1961 film The Innocence, which I think is one of the very few examples of a supernatural story that's told just perfectly. Why do you think this sort of film so often gets the tone all wrong?
I think it's kind of plagued by the notion of genre. If you start telling a ghost story, you have to tell the story within a framework of genre filmmaking. And genre filmmaking, you end up in some kind of movie Neverland, you know, which is defined by this completely Manichaean, this notion that there's the visible and there's the invisible, there's the good and the bad, and whatever is not visible is evil, is the evil with a capital E. And also, it's movies that end up being kind of rides, you know, they're there for just the thrill of the excitement of creating fear. I obviously have a very different perspective. You know, it's I'm using ghosts as part of the human experience, as something that has its own place in our imagination and echoes with more rational dimensions of our psychology, of our understanding of ourselves. So it's something that you can use as an element in a story. Here, I'm not making a ghost story. I'm making a movie about someone who's reconstructing herself, who's struggling to regain her identity in a certain way, because, you know, she's like cutting, like a character cut in half. And her relationship with the quote-unquote ghost of her brother has an essential element in her reconstructing herself.
Do you have a particular favorite or a couple of favorite ghost stories of your own?
Well, you know, it's hard to beat the turn of the screw.
Olivier Assayas's new film, Personal Shopper, is out now in the UK and in the US, and it's sure to be seen in other territories soon too. That's all for today. Next week, we're at the Barbican here in London for the Fashion in Film Festival and a very special screening of Henri-Georges Clouzot's unfinished film, The Inferno. We'll speak to the director of the project, Serge Bromberg. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your audio, and we'll leave you now with a Dusty Springfield track that you might remember from the Guy Ritchie film Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. This is Spooky. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.
I get confused, I never know where I stand, and then you smile.